Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung-Schulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And I don't know, this is like the Girl Interrupted episode or the like, we got a lot of stuff going on here episode. We are well distributed again this morning. I think Radha is with family. Lauren is solo parenting and my mother is visiting. And so basically, who knows what's going to happen over the next 45 or 50 minutes as we record this episode.
That's right. I was like, this is our emotional outlet. It's hard to know how much of it will be national security focused.
Right. It is 8 in the damn morning on a Saturday morning. And I would really like to wash my hair, but it's going to be a great episode.
But we are here to regale our many listeners with the important details of things going on around the world, all of which we have read about in the last 45 minutes and or 45 seconds to try to make sense of these many and various things. Ladies, what are we drinking? I assume it's a lot of coffee.
I'm on my second cup of coffee and I made fresh coffee as opposed to, I don't know if you guys know this, like I will drink coffee from yesterday reheated in the microwave.
Oh my God. Me too. I think this is leftover from the Department of Defense. I really do. I will drink coffee basically until it is empty. And I will also, if my coffee's gone cold, reheat it an infinite number of times.
Oh my God, you people are savages. How do you live like this? I'm buying you both Nespressos for Christmas.
I have an espresso. I just, it's fine. Coffee is coffee. Coffee is not for enjoyment. It's just there.
You two did work in the Pentagon too long because you drink Navy coffee and you don't understand that it could actually taste good and it's not just rocket fuel for your soul.
I do wash my coffee mug.
Me too. I don't just wipe it out with a wet paper towel. So that's my...
Thank God for small favors. Okay. So shall we start with keeping up foreign relations?
I guess we should.
Well, actually, we didn't really know where to file this one. We're going to start with the raid against Baghdadi last week in Syria since... We were not recording that week. We've had a few days to watch some, you know, fallout and for the hot takes to become, you know, a little cooler. Radha, can you bring us up to speed at all on kind of what happened and why we should care?
Yeah. So the long and short of it is the U.S. Special Operations Force is actually, it seems like it was a Delta operation rather than Navy SEAL. So, you know, diversity.
The army's getting in on it for a change.
Conducted a direct action raid and killed al-Baghdadi, who was the head of ISIS.
The caliph, in fact.
He was killed in this raid, as were a couple small children. It seems like there were some captures, some details have come out about how the operation was executed. And, you know, the president gave a long and winding speech about the raid itself, Baghdadi dying, sort of whimpering, being chased by dogs, which is part of a sort of continued U.S. information operations effort when killing leaders to try to prevent martyrdom. So it's pretty consistent, actually, with past presidents' speeches, though, you know, not always done in the best light. And, you know, now we're in a situation where ISIS has confirmed Baghdadi's death. They've named a new leader. There's a lot of Twitter discussion. We can talk about what that leadership means. But we also have some questions on the president's speech itself, whether he disclosed classified information, whether this type of targeted operation has any strategic effects / is there a strategy, and what this means for ISIS more generally in terms of their continued strength or lack of strength in the region and potential for regrowth.
And so part of what's interesting about this, one, obviously this raid occurs very shortly after U.S. ground forces are more or less withdrawn from this area in northern Syria. Two, Baghdadi himself is found in Idlib, which was, you know, kind of surprising to, Al-Qaeda watchers, ISIS watchers, and other folk kind of following the counterterrorism ops, CT ops in the region, in that Idlib was not an ISIS stronghold by any means. And as Radha, as you mentioned, there aren't a lot of ISIS strongholds at this point in the ground campaign. So there's some interesting ISIS, Al-Qaeda, who sold out whom kinds of things going on there. But this broader question of, you know, how do we manage to execute this raid, you know, withdrawing ground forces, and is this the sort of thing we won't be able to do in the future, is kind of a classic question of, you know, how does ground presence generate human intelligence and how does that then drive your counterterrorism operations? So
there is also an additional piece of that, which is, you know, the intelligence collection piece was not just from the U.S. forces, but also from our partners, most notably Kurdish and SDF forces. So there's a question of like how credible partnered operations, which aren't just kinetic operations, they're also intel collection. And so there's that open question as well.
So two things that struck out to me as worth exploring here is, first, a argument that we can actually have on this show about whether or not it is actually effective to take out leaders of terrorism organizations.
You're just addicted to disagreement now, Lauren.
I am.
Last
it's just
week.
So satisfying. And then also, I mean, this is something that has happened pretty regularly after recent counterterrorism raids. It's like, how useful is it to actually disclose all the details that we're seeing about this raid, which even as compared to prior ones, which are, have like books and movies, is pretty substantial in the week following. So I know that RADA obviously has views on the first one. What is the merits of actually continuing on the direct action high-value target-focused raids. And I know Aaron disagrees, and I'm somewhere in the middle, so I'll let them duke it out for a second before weighing in with the obvious solution.
I don't know what the obvious solution
There's
is
not
here.
One. I'm hoping to figure it out while you talk.
I mean, I think one thing that I reacted to, and Radha mentioned the president's press conference from last weekend, shortly following the raid, which was that this was, you know, finding Baghdadi was a top priority for his administration. And I guess part of my objection or, you know, skepticism on high value targeting as a substitute for strategy, and Radha will remind us that it's not a substitute for strategy, it's part of a broader strategy. But I'd like to see the evidence of the broader strategy, please. Part of kind of my objection is that's a weird priority. Like, what is it that gets you other than like a gold star or a press conference? I mean, or a maybe you're doing it for the information impact, but it trades off with a number of other things that you could be doing in the region or other even intelligence priorities. I mean, it's a non-trivial effort to, you know, link up all the different ints in order to get, you know, the precision and timing necessary to do a raid like this. So part of my objection, you know, was this question of like, really? Finding Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi was like a top priority of the presidency. That's a sort of thing that makes sense in a 2014-2015 context at some level, like from the politics of it. But, you know, given what the Iraqi forces were able to do in Mosul and kind of retaking that space, given the nature of, you know, the sort of the fall of Raqqa and like other things in Syria, we're really worried about finding and keeping this guy. He's holed up in Idlib. Who cares?
All right, Radha, let's schwack some bad guys.
Yeah. So I think the case for high value targeting really relies on sort of your theory of the case on what our counterterrorism objectives should be and how you think leaders play into the operational capability of their organization. So let me take the first one, which is if we think that the role of our counterterrorism operations are really to support more sort of political or non-operational objectives to bring stability and sort of greater peace to areas that foster and facilitate terrorist growth, then HVTs are not a huge necessary component of that unless you think a particular operator is like generating real strategic effects. So that's kind of the Aaron case. But if you think like, look, we're going to have regions that are ungoverned, politically messy, and frankly, going to give rise to anti-American or jihadi terrorist groups. And what we want to do is degrade capability for those groups to develop operational capabilities to have major impacts on US or allies, then unless you think the bench is really huge and every leader is as good as the past one, like they're perfect substitutes, killing guys who can lead operations has strategic effects. They're not sufficient. They're not enough to win the war, but they're enough to keep things below a certain threshold. And I think there's value to that. Now, in ISIS in particular, I think, you know, how we think leaders play into this is really related to their propaganda and recruiting rather than their operational capabilities. And I do think there's value in demonstrating the reach and capability of the US to kill leaders. And I think combining that with sort of worsening their bench and making it harder for them to plan openly by demonstrating that we will collect information, we will hunt you down and find you long after you think you're the most relevant guy in town, probably does have some effect both on their recruiting and their propaganda. And there's value in that too.
Well, there's no question that the knowledge that we are able to leverage multiple intelligence streams to track these folks definitely creates friction and undermines their kind of their own op tempo, right? Like the fact that we've twice now used couriers to find folks because they can't use any sort of electronic means of communication, like that is definitely going to put a spanner in the works of your, you know, global reach and operations. So that is one pretty good argument. And, you know, I think Jake Shapiro's book does a good job of kind of laying out the kinds of friction that that introduces. But the flip side, I think, I guess I quibble with the idea that it creates strategic effects, right? I think that it can create space in a narrow geographic campaign in order to pursue other activities. And in some ways, you know, the campaign against Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the predecessor to ISIS, is an interesting example of it. I think that campaign, that high-value targeting campaign, you know, first against Zarqawi, and but also against others, one, wasn't just about the high-value targets. It was really about degrading the entire organization. And two, generated a number of pathologies in our special operations forces that maybe aren't great and have some other, you know, long-term. The strategic effect is really the empowerment of SOF and our over-reliance on direct action. In the counterterrorism literature, the best case study that I know, or kind of analysis that I know, is still goes back to Israeli activity against Hamas in the early 2000s, where they didn't target, it wasn't high-value targeting, it was targeting bomb makers. And so they went after a cadre of bomb makers, kind of middle-tier, middle-management Hamas in the occupied territories, and, you know, really took out their ability, right? It was a specialized piece of knowledge, you know, as you say, Rada, not complete, not perfect substitutes. There was a finite number of people who could do it. I think that's a pretty interesting set of standards, right? So it's not something that like anybody could do. It's not something there's an infinite supply of, or at least not ready infinite supply. And that, again, that had, I would say, still only operational impact. It didn't lead to a peace settlement. It didn't lead to a, you know, radical improvement of Israeli security in the long term. But it did provide a window, and it basically put an end to the second intifada in terms of the suicide bombings that were happening. So remains a kind of complex, you know, piece of it. I guess my question is sort of, it's so easy to rely on this, and it's so easy to over-rely on SOF that I just feel like we've kind of overturned that wrench, and I worry about breaking off the screw.
I think that's fair. I just following up on the SOF point, I do think there's a sort of follow-up concern here on the over-reliance of SOF for this and then all of the other missions that have been added to the soft plate. And I think this is sort of, in some senses, what they, at least especially for some of these direct action teams, their specialty. And I have less of a problem having them focus on it when we don't add on a bunch of other things they're also supposed to be doing and fixing everywhere in the world all of the time. And I think your point starts becoming much more significant and much more binding, Aaron, in a world that we are in now where we use SOF for all sorts of missions, including but not limited to direct action CT force.
Okay, Lauren, have you solved the strategic problem for us?
I have not. I think I would just go back to a lot of conversations that I had with former Obama and Bush administration officials on this exact question. And they are all fairly candid about the fact that they are not certain that this the direct action high-value target strategy really solves anything, but are reluctant to release it in the absence of a bigger strategy, that mowing the lawn, as they called it, which is not exactly what this is. This is sort of like mowing the grass tops. That's a really horrible analogy. I apologize.
It's an Israeli phrase, though.
It is. Mowing the grass tops is better than nothing. And they are afraid to go to the nothing, not only as a strategic move, but also to be able to demonstrate to the American people that they are continuing to take the problem of terrorism seriously. I was also going to mention this over-reliance on SOF issue. And I think there's some real concerns about whether or not, because of their overemphasis on direct action, they are actually any good at a lot of the missions that they are supposed to be doing, like foreign internal defense and other things, which is a lot of what they should have been doing in Syria. Another point that you guys raised
to be clear, right? The Delta unit, the special mission units, are not those units, right?
Yes, so
there's sort of white soft, black soft, and those. Anyway,
we'll
have a separate episode on, you know,
the personalities of soft. One question I think also worth exploring is the degree to which this raid, and actually even the Bin Laden raid, really did rely on U.S. ground presence, because both of the ways that we acquired this intelligence was through was not through U.S. direct presence on the ground, or it may have been through relationships that we built through having presence in Syria and elsewhere. But it was not as though it was actual Americans who were achieving some of this intelligence, at least that we know of. But at this point, enough details have leaked about this raid that I think that we could be fairly confident in making some assumptions there. So if that's the case, can the United States achieve these kinds of direct action effects, high-value target effects, without necessarily having an abundant presence on the ground in the region? Or is it still really required for us to be in Syria to continue to focus on this element of the counter-ISIS strategy?
I think that's a great question, which is basically human intelligence. How does it work? And I think what's interesting here, just from, you know, again, what we know in the open source, and I don't think any of us have access to special reporting on this at this point, but, you know, is that these were probably supported by some of the other ints, you know, signals intelligence and other things. But really, the key elements of them were driven by human intelligence, which for the lesser high target raids, I mean, really, they tend to be driven by that SIGINT fusion. So that's sort of a weird intel thing that remains interesting to me. Okay, parting thoughts, closing assumptions, hot takes on the Baghdadi raid. We have, they also killed the number two in ISIS the same week. And as Radha mentioned, we have a new leader of ISIS, a Qureshi, and we'll sort of, who was announced as the caliph, not just as the leader of ISIS, but announces the new caliph. Although we're a little bit lacking in caliphates, as we noted.
My parting shot is that the Onion headline that a Navy SEAL would be writing a book about the Delta raid into against Baghdadi, which is pretty great.
Oh, the inside baseball.
Wow.
Radha, anything else from you?
No.
Okay, so meanwhile in the region, if we want to continue a little keeping up foreign relations, there have been large-scale protests in Lebanon and Iraq. And actually, this week, maybe even a couple of days ago, both the prime ministers of both countries basically offered to resign. Whether they're actually resigning or will in fact be replaced is another sort of complicated question. But basically, in the face of these sustained protests, which have been going on for several weeks now in both countries, Saeed Hariri and Abd al-Mahdi in Iraq both offered to resign, which I didn't realize and totally missed last week, which seems like kind of a big deal. So have you guys been paying any attention to these crazy protests?
On the protests in Lebanon, I mean, one thing I was sort of fascinated by is these protests have really only been going on for a couple of weeks. I mean, in terms of direct impact on a governing structure by people in the streets, like, that's pretty fast. Do you think it's the case that the president of Lebanon and some of his entourage are throwing Hariri under the bus and hoping that will kind of assuage the protesters' concerns? Or is it likely that protests are going to keep up over the next several weeks? Or I guess what's the next likely outcome that we're going to see here?
That's fascinating. And I'm kind of the farthest thing from a Lebanese politics expert. Certainly there's room to throw people under the bus. And I think there's a little bit of that happening probably in both countries a bit, because the president of Iraq basically served up Mahdi in the same way. Well, Mahdi went to him and said that I'm willing to resign if there's a replacement. On the Lebanon side, I think part of what's going on here, you know, there are different roles within the Lebanese government and they're each assigned essentially by sect. I apologize, I should have looked it up, but I don't remember exactly who's assigned to what, but there's basically a Catholic president, a Sunni rep, and a Shia rep, which is basically the way that they worked out power sharing to modulate tensions after a very long-running civil war in Lebanon through the 80s and 90s. And so it does seem, you know, from a kind of, I don't know, Western or other democratic perspective, 2 weeks of protests is not a big deal. But these have been substantially large-scale protests. And they're really about, and actually in both countries, like basic public, you know, public provision of goods. So electricity that runs 24 hours a day, you know, other forms of kind of healthcare provision and basic infrastructure, and just a real frustration that these kind of power sharing agreements, of which Iraq has a version of it, but it's different from Lebanon's, have just led to basically self-dealing cronyism, everybody using their part of the government to reward their kind of friends and family plan, as opposed to a broader set of kind of public good provision.
So in both of these cases, there is a sort of an outside player who has undue influence in the governing structures of the country. So in the case of Lebanon, Hezbollah, and in the case of Iraq, we saw Qasem Soleimani show up in Iraq basically to like smack down people to help decide the what was going to happen next, which I found to be fascinating. What is going to be Hezbollah's role in the future political settlement that goes on addressing the protesters' concerns or reforming a government in some way?
So this was actually really interesting as I was reading up on it. Hezbollah has basically come out in support of the status quo, which is a fascinating thing for a kind of revolutionary armed group to support, especially as they still are, you know, they Hezbollah is based in Lebanon South. They represent Shia groups from that region, and they've only been in parliament for a relatively short time. They were, you know, an armed opposition group, not a member of parliament until fairly recently. That said, the system is kind of working for them, and that's part of also what I think some of the protesters are reacting against. So it'll be interesting to see both how Hezbollah as a political party reacts to this, and if there's some sort of power sharing or revision to the power sharing agreement that locks them out, whether they choose to return to a more violent campaign or do some other sort of, you know, extra parliamentary activity to maintain their political influence. But that's a great question, and I think it's part of both of what's challenging. Because the reforms that the protesters, as best I can understand, in both Iraq and Lebanon are calling for aren't really for, like, we want a new prime minister, we want a new, you know, parliament. They are, we want to rewrite the power-sharing rules and the fundamental mm-hmm. ways that, you know, kind of power and patronage is managed in these countries. And that's a big deal, because those constitutions were put together for some pretty specific kind of counter-violence objectives. And it's not going to be straightforward to just sort of undo that and put something new together.
You know, when I was looking at this, admittedly, quite briefly, it seemed like there was a separate strain of reporting that related to Iran and their kind of reactions to these protests. And in particular, I think the Ayatollah had made some remarks about the protests. There's some concerns both that the protests were anti-Iranian and that the Iranians were worried that they might spill over, this sort of popular uprising issues might come up in Iran itself. So do we have a sense as to what the Iranian influence impact from these types of reforms from the protests are, or what to look for on that in the region?
I think that's another good question. As best I can tell, I mean, they're a little bit more involved in the day-to-day on the Iraqi side, and certainly in terms of their kind of who they would back as a prime minister, either replacement or whether they would try to back Mahdi going forward. The private military units, the paramilitary units, have also been part of the protests. You know, they were deeply involved in pushing ISIS out of Mosul in the north, and then have now they're sort of a second standing army or a partial standing, you know, army, and they have a lot of influence as well. Those have some Iranian backing. And so, I mean, yeah, this is not just a, like, you know, all politics is local, but the local is pretty broad in both of these countries, both of which have had significant foreign influence in their domestic affairs for, you know, well over 15 or 20 years, right? I mean, Lebanon has basically, you know, was essentially occupied by Syria with Iranian backing for a significant amount of time in the 80s and 90s. Pushing the Syrians out was a big deal, but there remains, Radha, as you know, both a lot of Iranian influence, but a lot of other countries too. I mean, the U.S. actually provides a significant amount of foreign military assistance to the Lebanese armed forces. Obviously, we have an interest in Iraq, and it will be interesting to see, you know, how the kind of different external sponsors duke that out. But what's interesting, at least to me right now, is the degree to which this is being played out on the ground by both sustained large protests, even in the face, I mean, in Iraq, over 250 people have been killed in the last month in these protests by the, you know, government forces. So that's part of what's kind of radicalized people and led to them to, you know, continue. But we will see, I guess, where this takes us. Shall we move on to our next Keeping Up Foreign Relations topic?
We should. I was really trying to find an amazing Qasem Soleimani meme that I saw last week, but I can't find it. So
who wants to talk about Brexit and the upcoming British general election?
So last we spoke about Brexit, Boris Johnson had humbled himself before the EU and the British people and to some degree the Queen in order to say that actually we are going to need just a little bit more time to actually figure out this whole Brexit situation, particularly since the plan, as we discussed last time, that he came up with sort of seemed based in a fantasy novel to a degree in terms of actual implementation. However, since that time, we have actually decided to pursue another election in December, which is, to me, kind of a fascinating outcome. Radha, what the hell is going on in the UK?
So to remind folks, there's this Brexit dealing going on that Boris Johnson, who's a prime minister, is trying to negotiate with the European Union and then get domestic political support for. In doing so, you might recall, he lost a number of members of the Conservative Party, basically making him no longer really having a functional governing majority in the parliament, which has a lot of complications, but specifically means he can't get anything done. So he needs to have an election in the hopes of winning more seats. And in that election, there's this question of sort of how does he think about forming different alliances? And the big, I think, sitting question on this relates to his alliance with the pro-Brexit party headed by this guy, Nigel Farage. Apparently, while doing a radio address, Nigel Farage was having a discussion and he invited a surprise special guest, none other than President Trump. That's right, our president.
I couldn't believe
Trump,
this.
Which is kind of amazing as it relates to norms of not intervening in other elections, but like bygones. And President Trump basically disparaged Corbyn, the leader of the Labour Party, and strongly encouraged Boris Johnson in the Conservative Party to forge a strong alliance with the pro-Brexit party to kind of make it through this election. And absent that, Farage has been threatening to run independent pro-Brexit candidates, which would likely split the Conservative majority and then like question mark exclamation point.
So one of the things that is, you know, I think important to realize about the British system is, so it's a parliamentary system, which means it's different than ours, you know, sort of a unified legislative and executive body. But the electoral side of their system is quite similar to ours. There's districts across the country. Whoever gets the most votes in the district wins. We call that Westminster or first past the post. And that tends to generate, you know, like a two-party system. And so for the last, you know, 100 plus years in the UK, that has been the Labour Party and the Conservative Party. And one of the things that Brexit has done has been to sort of chip away at kind of the integrity or the ossified nature of that two-party system. And so you see one, the Brexit Party led by Farage, who essentially affirmatively wants a hard Brexit. They don't want this deal. They don't want any Irish backstop. They don't want any of this kind of negotiated trade arrangements. They just want completely out. And they, you know, got almost 20% of the vote in the last election last year that Theresa May called. On the other end, or at least on a different end, you have the Liberal Democratic Party, the Lib Dems, who are kind of a free trade, you know, bit. I mean, they would kind of be familiar to a lot of Americans in terms of the kinds of things that they've tended to advocate for. More free market, less about certainly worker rights or social, you know, programs, but also firmly opposed to Brexit and have been trying to campaign on that. Which is interesting because, of course, Labour has kind of continued to struggle. Jeremy Corbyn is not exactly a Europhile. He does not love the European Union per se, has not been a strong campaigner for Remain as that people would like. And so Labour, I guess, is going to go through this election cycle, you know, trying to campaign on social programs and other things and not make it purely a Brexit referendum, which is a fascinating political choice. But we could really see a substantial number of seats going to both the Brexit Party and the Lib Dems potentially, and then no one has a majority. And the British system, unlike, you know, Italy or Israel or some of the other countries we talk about, the British system is not set up for coalition politics. Like, it is not set up, you know, to sort of, you know, make a majority out of multiple groups. And we've said nothing of the Northern Irish parties, which is who the Conservatives have been relying on up till now. So it's kind of a mess. And it's not, we're just keep kicking this can down the road. The new deadline is January 31st. The British election is December 12th. Merry Christmas.
And I think the really big question outstanding is, you know, one, how do the polls now relate to what you're likely to see at the election? So the Conservatives look like they have a pretty sizable support right now. That is absent a lot of crazy making that could happen, but also was true in the last election cycle, and they didn't win much then. Folks may recall that May tried this approach and actually ended up with fewer seats. So overall, you know, it's not promising for generating a lot of clarity on what is going to happen with Brexit. Also, literally no one who the Conservatives would need to agree with likes this Brexit plan. Like, the Irish Party doesn't like it. The Brexit hardliners don't like it. Labour doesn't like it. Like, it's not totally clear where the coalition on a Brexit deal is. So, you know.
You know what I think we need? This is a non-policy solution that doesn't make any sense. We really, really need a Love Actually sequel that makes the British people come together around what do we do about Brexit, so that, you know, I feel it in my fingers, I feel it in my toes. Brexit is all around us. What should we do next?
That's so Christmas 2019, I don't even know where to go.
Okay, Radha, you have a trade thing.
I do. And guys, it's super interesting. And I wish that I had had more time to learn more about this. But I think we should kick this off. And then at some point, I will try to find us a syphilis expert, because that's where we're going, guys. We're going on a syphilis tour.
Oh, wow. Are you going to explain to us what syphilis is?
I sure am. Okay, so great. For folks, that is the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. And it typically reviews deals by foreign acquirers for potential national security risks. So to take us back a little bit, TikTok is a big social media company. It's been growing sort of leaps and bounds, and about 60% of its users are, so it has about 25, a little more than 25 million users. 60% of them are Americans between 16 and 25 years old. So it's a pretty big U.S. young person's market.
I just want to pause for a second just to remark on the fact that half of our listeners are probably like, what the hell is TikTok? And the other half, like, why, Rotter, why are you explaining this?
So TikTok was actually acquired by a Chinese company, ByteDance, about 2 years ago. And there have been general concerns about sort of Chinese ownership of this, with U.S. persons using it and their practice of using user data, Chinese potential censorship of content. So a whole host of national security issues. TikTok had then been thinking of buying another company, Musical.ly, and that sort of opened them up to a potential investigation because of this purchase. So the CFIUS investigation has started. The CFIUS committee is now talking to TikTok about how they could potentially make this deal not be as concerning for national security risk. We don't actually know all of the details that the CFIUS folks investigate, because that is sort of closely held as confidential. But we do know that members of Congress actually sent a letter to the acting DNI, Robert McGuire, asking him to look into this and to look in particular at the storage of user data and use of user data by these companies. So it should be pretty interesting. And I think it's probably worth thinking a little bit on how this is likely to play out, both for TikTok specifically, but, you know, for Chinese companies investing in these spaces more broadly. There's this space, there's 5G, 6G discussion. So I think there's a lot coming in this space. And we've really only seen one big case like this that related to MoneyGram and a potential acquisition of that by a Chinese company a couple years ago that ended up being blocked by CFIUS, but really wasn't in this high tech media space. And so I think it's something to watch and something to try to understand once we see the decisions coming through.
Now, can you explain what VSCO girls are?
No.
Okay, that's all right.
I do think this is another good example more broadly of, you know, whether we want to call it major power competition or something like that, but basically what that kind of competition looks like under conditions of globalization, right? It's so different. You know, there were not Soviet companies trying to buy American companies in the 1960s, right? Or vice versa. So this kind of entanglement and the way that we, you know, the kinds of things that have, you know, national security implications are really different from them too. I mean, the CFIUS, you know, the laws underneath that are really about making sure that foreign companies can't disrupt like the ability to build airplanes. And so it's really about, you know, strategic metals or critical, you know, navigation parts or communication parts. The idea that a social media company has, you know, national security implications would have certainly not struck people as, you know, the goal of CFIUS in its original intent. On the other hand, you're turning over incredible, you know, a ton of details of American users to a foreign country that may or may not be, you know, have some discrete national security objectives with regard to those people.
And because it's not the technology itself that's sensitive, right? It's not the product. It's the users of the product who themselves have sensitive information. And again, the most analogous things to this are like these 5G and 6G networks that are also under discussion. But the networks themselves aren't the problem. It's that the sort of rules governing it. So it'll be interesting to see kind of what CFIUS settlements in these types of cases actually look like.
Perfect Radha topic. Could not be better. I wish you guys could see her face right now. She's so happy.
So happy.
But we're going to undo all that happiness by moving on to White House mayhem. I think, as we said last time, you know, we are not going to dive into the, you know, deep trenches of the day-to-day updates on impeachment. There are literally like 15 impeachment podcasts and probably 17 newsletters that people can subscribe to if they're into that at this point. But instead, you know, it turns out that this impeachment process is being driven by foreign policy actors and the National Security Council, which is fascinating on its own, right?
So
we're going to try to continue to provide a little bit of context on that. And it was a busy week on that front. What sort of happened in the national security testimony going on with the impeachment investigation?
Well, I didn't see the storyline where we had twins as part of foreign immigrant twins serving in active duty capacities in the National Security Council as key witnesses in the impeachment trial. So the writers really got me this season.
What's really funny, Rade, is that if it had taken place like a year and a half ago, it would have been the Bajraktari brothers.
Exactly what I was just thinking. Okay, so to rewind, it turns out that the, you know, National Security Council director for Ukraine had been an army lieutenant colonel who had been born in the former Soviet Union, and his family emigrated here in either the late 80s or the early 1990s, became citizens, and now are active duty army officers. And one of them was called to testify this week because he was on the call with between President Trump and Zelensky in Ukraine earlier this summer.
A lot of things came out of that discussion. We will focus mostly on the attacks that went on against him, but a few things to highlight. One, he gave us more detail about the editing process that on the transcript that we ultimately saw, and there was several omissions from the transcript that were released that he had tried to amend earlier. The fact that the White House counsel or the National Security General Counsel, who is also a White House counsel employee, directed that the transcript be stored on the super, super classified server, which is highly questionable for a number of reasons, namely that it is not actually classified at that level. And that there was a general atmosphere of please do not talk about this issue. There was a recognition that the president had screwed up in some way. Please do not further talk about this issue. Everyone stay mum. But the most concerning thing, I think, to particularly Rada and I, but many folks, was that as Lieutenant Colonel Vindman was taking the stand, the number of attacks on his character, his patriotism, and his ability to serve the United States as an Army officer were under question on mainstream media, I mean, particularly the Fox networks, but all over the place, about whether or not he had dual loyalties to the Soviet Union, to the Ukraine, whether or not it was possible that he was committing espionage just by doing his job. It was really just given the number of naturalized citizens and immigrants who serve in the armed forces and serve exceptionally well, really offensive to their ability to be a part of this military and be a part of this country. Rada, did you have other thoughts?
Yeah, so I think I was really taken aback by this. And in fairness, there were, I think, people on both sides of the aisle who were pretty shocked by the attacks on immigrants. You know, the immigration policy in the Pentagon has been the subject of debate, and we've talked about it on this podcast as it relates to this military sessions vital to the national interest, which allows non-U.S. citizens to serve when they have specific operational skills. And there's been this question of the trade-off between having sort of core competencies that we need, like language or cultural skills, and sort of background screening and connections. But in this case, you have an American citizen and someone who grew up in the U.S. and served honorably and, you know, in the military, continues to serve, being basically questioned on his loyalty for the country in which he was born and the background in which he had, which really kind of seemed like it was, in some senses, just naked attacks and xenophobia, not even couched in these terms of trade-off. The other point I would just make on this is that it's not totally clear to me where the substance of any sort of critique on him might come from, but the evidence on the immigration risks of having immigrants in the military in terms of any sort of screening or security risk just really isn't there. So I think even the best case scenario for these attacks seems to be empirically false. And in the end, these types of attacks really do both attack a human, and there's a human cost to it, but also make it seem like the military is not a place that you would want to serve if you were a first generation or second generation American or looked or sounded different than other people. And that is likely to have long-term impacts on recruitment and retention of the Force, which are pretty hard to reverse.
Those attacks are pretty appalling. And there was, as you know, Dorota, I think a fair amount of backlash against them, but it's still shocking to hear them in quite so many mainstream outlets, as you note. There's one other storyline in the impeachment saga this week that we're also kind of tracking, one of which, the big question is whether John Bolton will testify this coming week. And that, I mean, oh my God, like grab your popcorn. I can't even imagine what that would be like. But related to that is he and who? The Deputy National Security Advisor have basically asked a court to weigh in as to whether or not they are allowed to testify and need to follow a subpoena, which is kind of an interesting, I don't know, way to thread this needle between executive and legislative powers here.
It's just, you know, we might as well bring in a third branch at this point. They were feeling left out.
Well, other folks basically just accepted the executive privilege, right? Like, so Don McGahn has never, you know, gone to testify either with Mueller or other things because of the application of executive privilege. And we should, of course, note that we're not lawyers and we're going to totally make up the rest of this discussion here. But we've seen other, you know, employees of the executive branch, Fiona Hill, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, among others, the ambassador to Ukraine have all basically said, you know, regardless of our, you know, the guidance that was given, we're going to go ahead and testify. And so to see...
Well, Fiona Hill's went further, right? She said that privilege doesn't apply once misconduct has happened. Her lawyers had a pretty strongly worded letter kind of countering this executive privilege narrative.
Actually, even better, he made the argument that because there is no deliberative process in this administration, executive privilege is not even possible.
It's amazing. If you want privilege, you need process. It's incredible. And so, but you know, basically Bolton and Cooperman, I don't know if they're caught between a rock and a hard place, but they don't want to appear over eager in their efforts to testify. And so they're waiting to see if the court will compel them to do so.
Well, look, I think Bolton's a really interesting case here because he has historically actually been a strong proponent of basically infinite executive privilege, best I can tell.
Exactly.
And on the flip side, it sounds from existing testimony like he was deeply uncomfortable with the situation. And I will say this, I'm not sure there's like literally any policy issue that I would agree with John Bolton on, but I do not believe that he has been pursuing his things that I totally disagree with him on for personal gain. Like, I think he does have a sort of sense of national security service, just with a very different worldview from mine. So it's kind of interesting to see these two issues come at loggerheads in some senses for him.
It's been interesting to watch the Republican leadership strategy over the past week, which has, as leaked to the Washington Post, was effectively that we should just accept the fact that a quid pro quo happened, and that's okay because that is just part of foreign policy. That's a pretty big assumption that the American people will actually buy that and not be able to see the difference between quid pro quo for personal gain, but rather than for foreign policy matters as well. I don't know if the backlash to that story is going to cause them to revisit their strategy, but it is certainly like that as the narrative has come out more and more with evidence that Donald Trump did pursue foreign policy for personal gain. The fact that the Republican Party is saying like, we're just going to make that as part of what is OK in the execution of the president's national security responsibilities is a remarkable update from the writers of this season.
So one thing we have not talked about very much at all lately, and we're not going to dive into great detail here, is the budget process, which dominated conversation last year. And I just wanted to note, you know, both the House and the Senate had passed their own version of the National Defense Authorization Act, but they've been stuck in conference for quite some time. And there are a number of sticking points. But the top of the list, of course, again, is funding for the border wall. And so we are at total loggerheads over essentially $7 billion in spending, to the point where we're actually back now talking about having a continuing resolution or a skinny NDAA, which is what Senator Inhofe has put forward this week. And so, you know, we don't necessarily need to get into all of the gritty details here. Maybe we can, you know, discuss, you know how I love to discuss the defense budget, more of those, you know, next week. But what was... You know, after getting a budget deal earlier this year that looked like we would have clear sailing, we are stuck again on this border wall question and remain unable to get it out of conference.
I mean, it was always going to be challenging to get this NDAA through, no matter, even if the border wall had not been in there. There was just a lot that the House had added in terms of policy priorities that was always going to be challenging for Republican Senate leadership, whether it be nuclear weapons, transgender protections, some of the Space Force debate that is going on within them. So, but that was, to me, I was going to be interested to see how they managed to get a lot of that through, because I think some of it does have bipartisan policy support, but it's not a typical issue for the House and Senate Armed Services Committees to try to debate, at least not in the last 10 years or so. So I'm a little disappointed that the border wall is the monopolizing political debate, which even though it's quite important, because there's a lot of other things that really truly do need to get done, or at least need to be debated, and could have had interesting outcomes.
So I was going to say, I've been surprised at how little airtime really any of the other issues, and you mentioned Space Force and transgender protections. The other thing that caught my eye was the nukes issues, with a variety of different investments in the nuclear force that is likely to be kept out of the, quote, skinny bill, but is kind of, there are a number of partisan differences on it. But they seem like kind of core defense issues that we probably need to get to some kind of agreement on in order to get through and get investment in, especially for long acquisition and development cycles for some of these issues. So it's been a little bit frustrating, but also will be interesting to watch kind of where the debate on some of those more controversial issues ends up.
We shall see. Do we have any pop culture?
I do.
Yay!
Somebody flagged for me on Twitter yesterday that Lionsgate is apparently pursuing a television series in the Tamora Pierce Tortall universe. So if you've heard me and other guests talk about the Alana books, which is an amazing young adult fantasy series that has a lot of other branches to it, Alice Friend and I could not be more excited about the prospects of having a television series in this universe. It is a super kick-ass young woman feminist book that explores a series that explores all kinds of relevant issues, and I would absolutely get cable to watch this television show, which tells you a lot about me. If you don't know about me and cable, I haven't had it in 12 years, tells you a lot about my excitement level.
So mine is, I had been listening to the podcast The Report, which, by the way, I highly recommend, that kind of goes through the Mueller report, and felt that I was getting too depressed between that and my book on tape, which I was re-listening to, Wolf Hall in the Lauren Shulman Approach to Life. And so I decided to get the Ali Wong book. For folks who don't know her, she's a comedian who basically did her shtick while super duper pregnant, like 7 months pregnant the first round, and the second round did a tour sort of pretty soon after having her kid. And it's a little bit beyond my comfort zone, so I blush while listening to it, even though I'm the only person who can hear it, which is, I feel, really on brand. But it is a rollicking good time, especially if you have had kids and then tried to do work in any field at any point in time. I recommend it.
I wanted to add, this is not pop culture, but I believe I learned that Radha loves candy corn, but also I think Aaron loves candy corn.
I do.
You guys are so weird.
You like, have to eat it
disgusting.
One color at a time.
It is delicious.
It's amazing. It's very satisfying.
It is delicious.
My main pop culture this week is sports related, of course. The Nationals won the World Series. We're all very excited. There's a parade today on Saturday, which will be over by the time this podcast airs, so that's not useful information to anybody. There is a new John le Carré book out, which is, I think, called Notes from the Field. It's supposed to be very good. I have not read it yet. But in one of the articles about sort of interviewing him about the book, he noted that his son has a production company, which is who made The Night Manager, which was that great Tom Hiddleston vehicle a couple years ago, and that they are looking to option the Carla series under that production company. And so that is Tinker Tailor, Smiley's People, Honorable Schoolboy. And that could be fascinating if they get it right. It'll be less exciting if they totally screw it up like the last Tinker Tailor. Well, the last Tinker Tailor wasn't screwed up, but it just isn't my favorite. So as we look for our modern day Alec Guinness to play Smiley, there could be some very interesting developments on that front. Anything else, ladies?
Nope.
All right. See everyone in a couple weeks. Bye.